On this episode of Skeptico.
I do have to just kind of jump in there and take exception. This, we don't know, the brain is so complex thing. I mean, sure, we can advance that, but you're then just overthrowing like 50 years of neuroscience that says we understand the correlates between, for example, EEG or fMRI and consciousness. And we're just going to throw that out the window and say, well, it's all just a mystery, folks. All that stuff we thought we knew, we now don't know, just as a way of stepping over this NDE data.
And there's a sense in which I agree with where you ended your point, which is that we have no neurological model for this. However, it doesn't follow from that that we have, you know, good reason to think that these experiences transcend what's going on in the brain for reasons that, you know, we've just been reviewing, namely that all of the inferences along the way from the cardiac arrest shutdown, the EEG flatline, the subjective sense of when the experience occurs in relation to the objective timing of what's going on in the brain, our knowledge of what's going on in the brain based on an inference of a flatline EEG, that all of that is so fragile that we can't say, well, these experiences transcend the brain, which you just don't have that evidence.
It kind of depends on how you slice and dice the data. I mean, I just gave you verifiable empirical data. I think we have to talk about these two competing theories we have and which one fits the data and whether the neuroscience model of brain-based consciousness really holds up and whether it's been falsified. So, you know, I feel like we're kind of keep propping it up here and there to try and make it fit. I mean, if we're going to throw all that out and say, you know, we no longer have this understood correlation between EEG and fMRI and consciousness, then I think we have to say kind of all bets are off for the neuroscience model.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. Today we talk about near-death experience science, and we do so with a pretty feisty back and forth between me and Dr. Evan Thompson from the University of British Columbia. I have to say I really admire Dr. Thompson for sticking his neck out, joining me in this dialogue, and really trying to hash out these issues. I've been wanting to do this for some time. I have a great deal of frustration when I hear some of these dopey NDE debates, and they keep going over the same points, and they just seem to be stuck in a rut. I don't know that we totally got past this in this dialogue, but I did appreciate the chance to engage with Dr. Thompson on these topics because he is such a smart guy and he is so well-versed in this research. We have to give him credit for that. So we talk about a number of topics, including his rather unique background. He's well-versed in the Buddhist tradition and other spiritual traditions, but he's still at heart very much a materialist, as you'll hear in this interview. We, of course, talk about near-death experience science, and we even talk a little bit about quantum physics. Again, it was great to have Dr. Thompson on, and I thank him for joining me. I hope you enjoy the dialogue. Today, we welcome Dr. Evan Thompson to Skeptico. Dr. Thompson is a professor of philosophy at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. He's a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada and a very well-known scholar on the philosophy of consciousness, and as well as Buddhism, meditation, and all related interesting stuff that we like to talk about here on Skeptico. He's the author of several books, many, many scholarly papers. One book we might talk about a lot today is Waking, Dreaming, Being, Self and Consciousness in Neuroscience, Meditation, and Philosophy. Evan, it's great to have you on Skeptico. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks very much for having me. Good to be here.
So, Evan, you have a rather remarkable background, I think, and it must give you an amazing vantage point on the work that you do. Tell folks a little bit about your upbringing and your rather unusual education.
Well, I was raised in the 1970s as a kid and a teenager, mid-late 70s, at an organization that was founded by my father called the Lindisfarne Association. And what happened there is that my father was a university professor, and he felt in the early 70s that the universities really weren't serving society by providing the kind of learning that was appropriate for where the culture was going. And so in grand 1970s fashion, he quit a tenured full professorship and struck out on his own, set up an alternative community and educational institute that brought together scientists and philosophers and religious spiritual teachers and poets and artists and activists. And that's where I was raised. I was homeschooled there, actually. And so I was exposed to a lot of different voices and thinkers in science and religion and philosophy and art. And that very much, you know, has shaped my interest in all those areas and also how I approach all of these, you know, questions around the nature of the mind and consciousness, which is the area that I eventually wound up, you know, being most interested in. I went, to Amherst College as an undergraduate. I got my undergraduate degree in Asian studies, studied Chinese language and history, and was very interested in Asian philosophy and Buddhist philosophy in particular, and then decided to go on and get my PhD in philosophy, in Western philosophy, and did that at the University of Toronto. And so I've been teaching in philosophy departments ever since my academic career began. But I have this background, this unusual background, as you say, that that informs really how I approach the work that I do.
Fantastic. That's really great. And what a story. I mean, for your dad to do that's pretty amazing. You know, in your latest book, Waking, Dreaming, Being, you weave together science, philosophy, and a really nice personal narrative. And you do it in kind of unique way. I was reading from another interview that really took some time to find the voice and really get that right. Can you tell folks a little bit about what they'll find in that book?
Yeah. So what I try to do in the book is to weave into the philosophical, scientific narrative a lot of anecdotes, stories about personal experience. And it did take me a while to figure out how to do that in the writing. I had come from mainly academic writing. So writing something where there's a personal story woven into the text wasn't immediately natural to me. But I worked at it, and the way that it was most immediately easy for me to do is that there were several chapters in the book on dreaming. And so I started out trying to write in a more personal vein by just using, you know, narratives from my own dreams in order to illustrate the ideas about dreaming that I was dealing with in the book from the philosophical and scientific and contemplative perspective. So it started out, the personal element in the book really started out in the form of dream narratives, but then it kind of generalized and broadened throughout the book. And, you know, it's for the reader to decide how well it works, but I wanted to do something that sort of shows the life behind philosophy, I suppose you could say. I mean, academic philosophy is very much about hiding your personal life and just presenting, you know, in as objective and clean a way as you can, the force of the argument. And there's a lot of merit to be, you know, a lot of merit in that kind of writing. But I wanted to kind of give the reader a sense of the story behind the philosophy and, you know, why someone in terms of their own upbringing and history would come to be concerned with these questions. And that really required, you know, telling something about my story.
Awesome. In the book and in your other public presentations, you talk a lot about consciousness, obviously, and you stress staying with the open question, that question being whether consciousness is brain-based, that is the mind equal brain model, or whether it's not. Can you tell us a little bit about why you think that's so important?
Yeah, so I use the expression staying with the open question, which is actually a phrase that came from my mentor, Francisco Varela, who was a pioneering neuroscientist, also a practicing Buddhist, and someone who pioneered the science-Buddhism dialogue. And he used this phrase in an interview towards the end of his life, where he said, you know, look, I'm a neuroscientist, and from the neuroscientist's perspective, it just doesn't make any sense to think of consciousness as something that could transcend the brain. That, you know, if you're a neuroscientist, you're a biologist. And if you're a biologist, consciousness is dependent on the body and it's part of, you know, the life of the body. And then he said, on the other hand, I'm a practicing Tibetan Buddhist. And from the traditional Tibetan Buddhist perspective, consciousness is ultimately transcendent of the brain of that particular biological structure or indeed any biological structure from the traditional Tibetan perspective. And so he used this question very near the end of his own life. He died of liver cancer, where he said, there's a question that's not resolvable, and he was speaking, you know, in that instance very personally, about what's going to happen to consciousness at death. And staying with the open question means not trying to force any particular answer from either a Buddhist perspective or a science perspective, but simply remaining open. And I interpret that in a very, I suppose, philosophical way, where the idea is not to foreclose the question, not to prejudge the evidence or what the evidence could be, and not to fall to the extreme of thinking that our present day science tells us, you know, everything about the way the world is, or to the other extreme, which is that traditional religions whose belief systems were formed not in our scientific context, that they have necessarily the right view either. And so in my own book, I take that idea of staying with the open question as a kind of guiding motive for the book, of trying to follow the argument wherever it leads as rigorously as possible from the perspective of a philosopher who wants to follow the thread of the scientific evidence, but who also wants to remain true to the nature of consciousness as first-person experience.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing you do seem to be moving past in the book and in your other writings is this neuroreductionism, materialism, oftentimes associated with the Daniel Dennett, consciousness is an illusion. Now, I take it that that's kind of out for you.
Yeah, stated that way, I wouldn't subscribe to it. I know Dennett quite well. I actually did a postdoc with Dennett, and I have great admiration for his work, and he was very generous with me. However, the view that consciousness is an illusion, and that basically what neuroscience tells us about how the brain works today, that that's enough to understand consciousness, and I think it's fair to say that that's Dennett's view. That's not my view. I think there really is a fundamental gap in our understanding. We have an increasingly sophisticated understanding of the brain, but we really don't understand how the brain could be the basis or the source or the kind of contingent platform, however you want to put it, for consciousness. And so there's a big question for us there. And I think that the materialist solution is just much too quick with that question. So I don't find it satisfying. I think the idea of saying that consciousness is an illusion doesn't really work, because the very notion of an illusion presupposes consciousness. There are no illusions unless there is a conscious experiencer for whom there is an illusion. So that doesn't really work for me either. At the same time, however, I wouldn't want to go to the other extreme and say, well, consciousness is intrinsically mysterious, we'll never be able to understand it. So that's the position of say, someone like Colin McGinn or maybe Thomas Nagel. So that doesn't seem to me to follow necessarily either. And then I don't want to go to, let's say, a different kind of extreme, which would be a traditional Indo-Tibetan Buddhist view, which says that consciousness is non-physical, that it's immaterial, and that its nature is radically different from the brain, or let's say from living biology more generally. So I try to thread my way through those difficult places to remain true to what I think is really a touchstone in the end, which is the phenomenology of consciousness. That is, in some sense, whatever we're going to say about consciousness is at the end of the day going to come back to our understanding of it through our own lived experience. And that's, you know, that's very much a principle of phenomenological philosophy in the sense, coming from, say, Husserl in Western thought, this idea that phenomenology, the logic of consciousness, of our experience, as we live it in the first person perspective, that's really in a way a source. And indeed, it's a source for all of science, because science depends on observation and observation depends on consciousness.
Okay, but as you're threading your way through here, I wonder where you're really landing. You talk about an inactive view and you liken it to dancing. I'm wondering, are you talking about an emergent property? I mean, we kind of have some sense in biology of this idea of emergence, and a lot of people have likened consciousness to being an emergent property of the brain without really ever identifying what the constituents of that emergence would be. I mean, if you in the book, you liken it to dancing. In dancing, though, we can model dancing. I can tell you what makes up a dance. I can even predict how a dance will turn out. I can't do that with consciousness. Does this emergent property thing really fit here?
Yeah, so there's two things there. One, I use the dancing metaphor really when I'm talking about the self. So there the idea is that the self isn't an entity or a thing. It's a process in the way that, or analogously to the way that dance isn't a thing or an entity, it's a process. So a dance is the dancing, and a self is something that's enacted in the process of awareness. And there are different ways of experiencing the self, depending on whether we're awake or asleep or dreaming or lucid dreaming and so on. So the dance metaphor is really meant to capture that, not so much meant to capture consciousness. Now, with regard to emergence, there's a sense in which my view is an emergentist view and a sense in which maybe it's not. So the sense in which it is an emergentist view is that I think we have very good reason to believe that the cognitive complexity of consciousness, by which I mean the differentiation of different modes of consciousness in terms of different sensory systems or the ability to think consciously and grasp something in thought, that the complexity of that increases as a function, you could say, of biological complexity. So that the repertoire of possible conscious states for a human being is much, much greater in terms of its cognitive abilities than, say, the consciousness of a rat or an insect. So in that sense, I'm an emergentist. I think consciousness is contingent on our biological makeup. The cognitive complexity of it is contingent on the cognitive complexity of our biological structure, and that emerges over the course of evolution and development. Now, the sense in which I'm not an emergentist is exactly the sense in which I was talking about before, that there is a kind of gap in our knowledge of how it is possible that there is consciousness in the natural world at all. It's one thing to say, look, we can see that it increases in its complexity according to evolution and development. It's another thing when we step back and say, yes, but why is it the case that there is consciousness at all? And that's the so-called hard problem. That's the so-called explanatory gap. And my view about that is that we're not really able to deal with that problem adequately given our present conceptual framework. So what I mean by that is our present conceptual framework is one in which we think that what it is for something to be physical fundamentally at the end of the day is not mind-involving in any way, that we can say what it is for something to be inherently physical without mentioning anything about consciousness or the mind. And then when we talk about consciousness, we can do the same thing. We can talk about the intrinsic qualitative feel of something. And when we're talking that way, it doesn't seem like we're talking about anything physical. But I think that's just a conceptual structure that we happen to have inherited from the way that science and philosophy have evolved over the past, you know, 500-600 years, even older, maybe, depending on how you want to date it. And so I think in order to really understand consciousness, we would need a kind of revolution in our understanding of nature so that we wouldn't set the physical and the mental apart from each other in that oppositional way. So we would really need a kind of deep revolution in our understanding of what it is for something to be physical or what it is for something to be natural in a way that didn't take those concepts as just from the start inherently opposed to mind and consciousness. And it's one thing to say what I just said. It's another thing actually to work that out in the context of, say, science. And, you know, I don't think we're near to doing that, though we might be able to do that in 100 years, 200 years. I don't know. Certainly some scientists and philosophers have tried to do that with varying degrees of success. So that's my view at the end of the day about, you know, emergence is that, well, it definitely is an important notion in the context of biology and cognitive science. But if we step back and ask this much bigger question about, well, how is it possible for there to be consciousness in a biological and a physical world, then we are going to need some deep transformation of our thinking and our concepts. At least that's what I believe.
Okay, great. But you have kind of ventured into that too, and I'm glad you brought up science and this contingent on the biology idea, because one thing I pulled out of your writing, I mean, obviously you are a first-rate philosopher and thinker and a darn good writer to boot. The book is extremely entertaining and rich in kind of literary talent. But let's get down to bedrock. Talk about some of the science. These are questions that we've certainly addressed in this show about consciousness and about consciousness and brain function. I've heard you state in a number of different interviews and places that there's no convincing evidence for consciousness without the brain. And that's something I'd really like to drill into, because really we have dealt with that a lot, and I think we can have an interesting dialogue about it. But in the spirit of openness, I'd kind of ask that we maybe reformulate that question a little bit so that we can nail it down scientifically. Let me throw this out and see if you can agree to that. This is the question we might want to kind of toss around. My framing of it would be, neuroscience's current model of brain-dependent consciousness is incompatible with some of the well-established observable data that we have. So I don't think it's a matter of convincing someone one way or another. It's just a matter of kind of laying all the data out and saying, hey, does our current model of neuroscience, mind equal brain, does it really hold up to the data that we're getting in?
Okay. Yeah. No, I think that's a useful way to go. I think, I mean, one just qualification I might give to that is, there are ways of talking about consciousness or sentience, we might say, in which some people, and I certainly can be persuaded of this viewpoint, in which sentience is a wider biological phenomenon than, say, creatures that have a brain. So some people want to talk about cellular sentience or plant sentience or consciousness in animals that don't have a nervous system, or living beings, I should say, that don't have a nervous system. And I think, you know, that's an interesting question, whether there's a sense of sentience that really encompasses all of life, maybe, and not just creatures that happen to have brains. Yeah. But I take it that that's not really what you're concerned with. Your concern, as I understand it, is really, well, given consciousness in, you know, it's recognizably familiar lived human form, what's the state of the evidence for whether that kind of consciousness is or isn't brain dependent? Am I right?
Okay. Exactly. And I think you nailed this in your book, which we should mention to folks. You have another book, kind of a excerpted selection from your main book on Amazon. The title of it is Dying, What Happens When We Die, a selection from Waking Dreaming Being. And it's on Amazon. It's only $1.99. Anyone can go pick it up and pop it on their Kindle. And in that, you really deal extensively with, I think, this question of dying, because in a lot of ways, I mean, we could talk about a whole bunch of stuff. We could talk about self-directed neuroplasticity or psi or reincarnation research, or all sorts of stuff that we've talked about on this show. But I like how you've put your finger on this issue of dying, and in particular, near-death experience research, because when it comes to neuroscience's mind equal brain hypothesis, this really puts our finger on it. I mean, if NDEs are what they claim to be, what Dr. Pin von Lommel claimed them to be when he contacted you and wrote you a letter that kind of spurred you to do this work and look into it. If that's true, then we do have a game changer. There's no need for qualifiers or ambiguity. So tell us a little bit about what you tried to capture in this book, Dying, What Happens When We Die.
Yeah. So the story there is that I wrote a paper with a neuroscience colleague of mine. He was a student, one of the last doctoral students of Francisco Varela. His name is Antoine Lutz, and he's also done a lot of work on the neuroscience of meditation. And we wrote a paper together that we called Neurophenomenology, in which we proposed an approach to the neuroscience of consciousness that would combine state-of-the-art neuroimaging and EEG with experimental participants who had trainings, for example, through meditation, in being able to observe their own experience and report on it more precisely. So we wrote this paper, and we received an email. I received an email from Dr. Pim van Lommel So this would have been back in, say, 2003 or 2004, in which he said, you know, I read your article. I thought, you know, the approach that you're proposing is interesting. I want to call your attention to near-death experiences, which would seem to be a kind of experience that goes beyond even the brain phenomenology framework that you're proposing. And I knew about near-death experiences from, you know, their popular representation. And I had, you know, read, I suppose, some, you know, articles about them, maybe more journalistic articles. And I thought, well, you know, that's very interesting. I need to look at the near-death experience literature and, you know, see what's going on there. And this was at the time when Pim van Lommel had just published a paper in The Lancet where they had done this prospective study looking at survivors of cardiac arrest and reports of near-death experience. So I went and I read that paper and, you know, sort of followed the trail, reading as much of the near-death experience literature as I could. And I went into it thinking, well, if these experiences are as they are reported and as they are described, then it would seem prima facie that they would pose a very serious challenge to the default neuroscience assumption, which is that consciousness is contingent on the brain, and when the brain is not functioning, consciousness is not possible. But as I read through the literature, I really became unconvinced, I suppose you could say, because the way that these experiences are described and presented is far beyond what the data actually tells us. And in my reading of this literature, there really is, at the end of the day, there are a lot of interesting anecdotal reports, but there's no, from a scientific perspective, compelling data that indicates that consciousness is present when the brain is not functioning. And I therefore became, I suppose you could say, quite skeptical with the ways that these experiences are popularly presented and the ways that they're presented within the near-death experience community. And this is a delicate issue because, you know, these are experiences that I believe are very robust as experiences. Many of them occur in situations where people are in these, you know, life-threatening situations like cardiac arrest. These experiences are often very transformative for people who then are successfully able to, you know, resume their lives. So I don't have any doubt that the experiences themselves are very powerful. And I also don't have any doubt that the experiences are unique in the sense that they're not, we can't assimilate them to just dreams, let's say, as someone might wish to do, or to hallucinations. There's good clinical evidence now that these experiences have certain constellation of unique features that makes them not really assimilable to any of those categories that we would have in advance. At the same time, I don't see that there is evidence for example, verifiable out-of-body perception or evidence that the brain is actually shut down and not working when these experiences occur. There's issues about how to time these experiences. So the reports that people make are obviously in situations of cardiac arrest, these are life-threatening situations. So the reports people make of these experiences are memory reports that are much later. And they're really difficult issues that cognitive psychologists are especially familiar with, and how to relate the subjective sense of when an experience occurs, subjective time, to the objective timing of events that may be represented in the experience, or for that matter, events going on in the brain and the body. And the evidence as I see it is still very much compatible with the idea that these elements of these experiences happen on the way into a loss of consciousness and on the way out, that or on the way back to recovery of consciousness, not that they're happening in the complete absence of consciousness as we or let's say consciousness as we ordinarily understand it. And then there are really deep questions in neuroscience about, you know, what's happening in the brain during these experiences. And in most of these studies, we just don't know. You know, a surface electrode flatline EEG is very rare in cases of these experiences. And people infer that the brain is inactive because of the heart failure. But that's a kind of inferential step that's actually problematic, especially with regard to deep brain structures that we wouldn't be able to measure in terms of a surface EEG recording. So there's just a lot of questions, I think, that are really open about what's happening in these experiences. I think it's important to investigate this as much as we can, given the ethics of the situation, of course. But I'm very, as a result of diving into the literature, which I went into, actually in some ways really interested to find a kind of anomaly in Thomas Kuhn's sense. Well, would this really be an anomaly to the neuroscience view? That was kind of how I went into it. And I came out thinking, well, it's just not in terms of the current state of our knowledge and evidence.
Yeah, that's interesting. And you do lay all this out, folks. He lays all this out in this book in quite an extensive way, well organized into these four different kind of main points that Evan just touched on. But to recap, von Lommel sends you this letter and he says the NDE thing, that, hey, there's these near-death experiences. He's a cardiologist. He's studied these things for 20 years. He's worked on thousands of patients, hundreds of them with this NDE. And he said, hey, during this time that these people are reporting this, their brain is so severely compromised that it's impossible to generate these near-death experiences, which we should just kind of fill someone in if they're totally coming from the dark. And one of the things about near-death experiences is there are these hyper-lucid experiences that many people report as being the most significant experience of their life. It's very vivid. People remember this more than they can remember anything else in their life, they often report, like it happened yesterday. So this is the kind of experience, and von Lommel was saying, hey, this is happening at a time when the brain is severely compromised. It can't possibly be any kind of neuroscience model. And you're coming along and saying, not so fast. I've looked at the research, and we don't know when those NDEs are occurring. And maybe they're occurring at a time when the brain isn't compromised, as you said, when it's going into the shutting down process, or when it's coming out, or much later and they're recalling it. So since this is a question that I've spent 50 at least shows addressing with some of the leading researchers and scholars that I could find, I wanted to kind of bounce some things off you and see where we wind up, because I really come to a completely different conclusion. And I have to tell you, a lot of the points that you're making to me seem like things that have been handled over and over again by near-death experience researchers over the years, and they never seem to stick. I mean, first, let's start with regard to the flatlining of the EEG and whether we have any measurement of that with people who have undergone a near-death experience. So again, this is something that skeptics have floated out there for years. They said, oh yeah, sure, the person had a cardiac arrest and they were out for 2 minutes and then they were resuscitated, but we don't know whether they really had a flat EEG during that time. And what I did is I went and asked an EEG expert, and I found one at the University of Toledo, Dr. John Greenfield, because he's written one of the kind of most quoted books on understanding EEGs. And I asked him directly, what's going on before, during, and after the flatlining of an EEG. And I'll tell you what he told me, and that's that through years and years of study, because the EEG has been around for such a long time as a tool, and it's just a tool for measuring brain activity, right? There's nothing magic about EEG. It's just a tool, and now we have some better tools. But we've studied it extensively on both humans and animals. And we know that right before, certainly during, and right after the heart stops, there is very little going on in the brain that we would associate with the conscious experience. When you ask these folks directly, not the kind of debunking question like, is it possible that there's something here or there or deep in that we haven't discovered? But you just ask them that based on the decades of work we have compiled with EEGs, is there any chance that these hyperlucid, vivid experiences could be happening at this time when this brain is so severely compromised, like after cardiac arrest? They just tell you there's no way. So so really what gets me about it, the skeptical position, is that the notion that Pen Van Lommel, who again is this cardiologist, I mean, he works with these people all the time. He understands what it's like for people to have cardiac arrest, what it's like for people after they're resuscitated, how they are don't recall anything, how they're extremely amnesiac for usually for weeks. And to think that this guy has just kind of fumbled through and made this huge glaring mistake in terms of evaluating the medical condition of these patients, I just can't buy that for a second.
Yeah, well, I certainly wouldn't say that, though. I wouldn't say that, you know, people are bumbling or they make huge medical mistakes. I would say rather that there are cardiologists whose knowledge is specialized for a certain kind of domain, namely heart function and the treatment of that. And they're dealing with patients in life-threatening situations. And these are not neuroscientists or cognitive neuroscientists who are familiar with the complexities of investigating reports of experience and brain activity in relationship to those reports. It's just, it's not to say that there's any bumbling. It's just that, you know, this is not an area where it's been investigated. Now, with regard to the point you made about EEG, there's two things there. One is that it takes time for the EEG to go to flatline, and that's variable depending on the person and depending on the conditions. When it goes flatline, it's a recording made at the surface of the scalp. We have very few recordings of what actually is the course of the EEG during these traumatic events for obvious reasons. That's not the prime concern. But it takes some time. It's variable. And then just because you have inactivity of the brain recorded at the surface of the scalp, that does not tell you about much, much deeper brain structures, some of which we know are crucial to memory and the ability to form mental images. It doesn't tell you about what is going on at that level. Biologically, when an organism dies, things decay at very, very different rates depending on what they are, the kinds of cells they are, the kind of connections they have, all sorts of metabolic factors. So we can't just infer from a flatline EEG that the brain is somehow turned off. The
but
brain
we
is
can. Not- That's exactly no. what the EEG experts tell you. They say we have decades of work with EEG and consciousness and the correlation between the two. And we have no evidence that anyone ever has a conscious experience, let alone this kind of hyper lucid, super duper conscious experience when the EEG is flat. And as to your other point, we understand pretty darn well, just like Von Lommel told you on the stage there when you two were presenting together, that, you know, medical science, we understand pretty darn well what happens to your EEG during cardiac arrest. And just because we don't have every person who suffers cardiac arrest hooked up to an EEG doesn't mean that we can't infer, based on that huge body of knowledge, what is probably going on with their EEG. I think the only question is the near-death experience happening during this period of, like, for example, when they're being resuscitated?
Well, but this is my point about the EEG, is that there's a variable window for the EEG going flat, and so the person is descending into the crisis, as it were, and that window of time leaves plenty of time for all sorts of subjective experiential things to happen. Then there's the time in which the person is reemerging into consciousness, and of course that's a time in which all sorts of subjective experiential things can happen. And then there's the zone that we don't really know much about in terms of deep brain function, which is, again, that just because the EEG is flat, you can have a flat EEG and it still may be possible. And this is something that we don't know. And any scientist who says that we do know, I would take issue with. We don't know in terms of much deeper structures exactly what their time course of shutdown is in relationship to the moment at which an EEG goes flat. Now, there was just a study, for example, albeit in rats, that was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences a couple of years ago, where, and this is not a very nice experiment, they basically induced cardiac arrest in rats, and they see a huge surge of brain activity, a very complex pattern involving multiple frequencies and shifting patterns of coherence that happens in the 30 to 40 seconds after the cardiac arrest, and then you see prolonged activity in the brain for up to 30 minutes after the cardiac arrest. Now, that's a startling finding in relationship to the classical medical view that just basically says you have a heart attack and your brain shuts down. No, the brain is an extremely complicated system made up of many different kinds of cells with incredible connectivity, and it doesn't just turn off when blood flow and oxygen are no longer being delivered. It goes into a kind of huge, you know, phase change of activity that can actually be quite protracted. So,
well,
the bottom line here is that we don't actually really know the answer to these questions.
Well, I we can always say that. And let's talk about the Bajorgian University of Michigan study in a minute, because I want to go back and touch on the other question I think that you raised, which I think is a legitimate question, but to a certain extent it's been answered. And that is, are these near-death experiences happening during the time when this brain is really severely compromised, or are they semi-conscious and just kind of going in and out of consciousness, and is that when it's being formed? I do have to just kind of jump in there and take exception. This, we don't know, the brain is so complex thing. I mean, sure, we can advance that, but you're then just overthrowing like 50 years of neuroscience that says we understand the correlates between, for example, EEG or fMRI and consciousness. And we're just going to throw that out the window and say, well, it's all just a mystery, folks. All that stuff we thought we knew, we now don't know, just as a way of stepping over this NDE data. But I digress, because here's the research. We have some good empirical data that suggests that these people really are out when they're having the near-death experience. And I've talked to Dr. Penny Sartori, also Dr. Jan Holden at the University of North Texas, who you reference in your book and is one of the editors, along with Dr. Bruce Grayson, of the Handbook of Near-Death Experiences. And what they did, which it was an ingeniously simple experiment, they went on the cardiac arrest ward and they had two groups of people. One was the control group, people who had a cardiac arrest and were resuscitated and didn't have a near-death experience, didn't report that. And the other group had a cardiac arrest and had a near-death experience and were resuscitated and obviously came back to life. And they just went and they asked them in a very systematic, scientific way to recall their resuscitation experience. And then they evaluated whether or not they were, as they claimed, above their body, outside of their body, recalling the resuscitation. So they kind of scored it and saw who was more accurate, the control group that didn't have a near-death experience or the group that did have a near-death experience. And in both these independent studies, they find a highly significant evidence in favor of the idea that these people really did see their resuscitation and that they reported that in a way that is totally different from the control group. The control group, the people who didn't have an NDE, when you ask them, they were like, well, I don't know. I was dead. I was out. I was unconscious. And they just kind of give a Hollywood version of it. And the other version from the near-death experiencers is really precise. Now, if you go and talk to cardiologists and you talk to people who are in this emergency medical condition, they'll tell you a couple things that I've learned. One, they'll tell you that this resuscitation process, despite what you see on TV, doesn't begin instantly. When a person has a cardiac arrest, the doctors I've talked to has told me that it's very unusual in a large hospital for that person to be resuscitated within a minute. It's usually after a minute or even 2 minutes after they're gone before they are able to resuscitate them. So when we talk about people recalling their resuscitation, we can be pretty darn confident that their brain state was in this or very, very close to this flatline state. And what I just say, it's just severely compromised to the extent that we have no neurological model for how that kind of brain could generate a consciousness experience. It totally blows that away. And then I want you to go ahead and respond to that, and then let's talk about the University of Michigan rat study.
Well, so, I mean, there's a sense in which I agree with where you ended your point, which is that we have no neurological model for this. I think that that's right in the following sense. That is, these experiences that people report have distinctive phenomenological features that make them, let's say, belong to a different phenomenological class than dream experiences or waking hallucinatory experiences. So there's no question that they are unique as a class of reported experiences, reported now on the basis of memory, and that we don't really have a good neurological model for those kinds of experiences. I agree with that. However, it doesn't follow from that that we know definitively, or even in a sort of not leaving out definitively, that we have, you know, good reason to think that these experiences transcend what's going on in the brain for reasons that, you know, we've just been reviewing, namely that all of the inferences along the way from the cardiac arrest shutdown, the EEG flatline, the subjective sense of when the experience occurs in relation to the objective timing of what's going on in the brain, our knowledge of what's going on in the brain based on an inference of a flatline EEG, that all of that is so fragile that we can't say, well, these experiences transcend the brain. If you look at reports about verifiable out-of-body perception, for example, in the Near-Death Experience Handbook, there's a chapter by the researchers you just mentioned on verifiable out-of-body perception. And you actually look at that chapter carefully, there's extremely little, if any, evidence at all of verifiable out-of-body perception. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence of people reporting out-of-body experiences, and those can be subjectively very compelling. I mean, in my own book, you know, I describe some of my own out-of-body experiences. They weren't near-death experiences. They were, you know, I was perfectly fine and healthy, but they were experiences I had of being out of body, and they are very, very vivid and compelling. However, in terms of evidence of verifiable perception, that's a whole other situation which we just don't have that evidence.
It kind of depends on how you slice and dice the data. I mean, I just gave you verifiable empirical data because what they did was very smart. They didn't try and go, you know, line by line and say, okay, you said that you saw the sneaker on the ledge, you know, let's go see it. They did it in a well-understood scientific way of saying, okay, let's score your evaluation of your resuscitation process and compare it to a control group. That's the kind of work that I find, you know, compelling because it's solid science. The other point that I'd make, which I think is the main point in this that we started with, I think we have to get away from this idea of proof and convincing and this and that and talk about these two competing theories we have, in which one provides us parsimony, which one fits the data, and whether the neuroscience model of brain-based consciousness really holds up and whether it's been falsified. So, you know, I feel like we're kind of keep propping it up here and there to try and make it fit when we say, like, I think I'm taking what you're just saying and I take that as a total movement away from the existing neuroscience model. I mean, if we're going to throw all that out and say, you know, we no longer have this understood correlation between like EEG and fMRI and consciousness, then I think we have to say kind of all bets are off for the neuroscience model. And that's where I'm at.
Right. Well, I don't think that's our situation, that we're throwing out the EEG and the fMRI. I mean, in point of fact, what the EEG and the fMRI in the context of the neuroscience of consciousness indicates is that it's a way more complicated story than just consciousness present, you know, or absent with regard to, you know, a waking EEG versus a flatline EEG with one electrode or two or three. Sure. On the scalp. And that's not the state of the neuroscience. So the kind of neuroscience evidence that we have, for example, about what happens when you dream, where we have very sophisticated high-dense array EEG, where we have fMRI, where we have PET, where we have very careful and precise ways of collecting dream reports and scoring them. So this is fantastic science that has evolved over the past, you know, 50, 60 years. Well, we don't have that kind of comparable cognitive neuroscience for near-death experiences. Now, for obvious reasons, because, you know, people in many of these experiences are in, you know, situations that are life-threatening. I think it would be, you know, much, much better if we did have that kind of scientific evidence through a kind of sustained investigation to the extent that we can do it in these cases. So I think we just need to be clear about the state of investigation here and the state of the science. We're not talking about throwing out anything. We're actually talking about taking a very well established and progressive research program for investigating the brain in relationship to consciousness and noting that it's actually more or less absent in the case of investigating near-death experience, that most of what's said is said by people who are cardiologists who are very familiar with the patient situation, the crisis, and who are doing, you know, important work, but who aren't trained psychologists and cognitive scientists in dealing with consciousness, with some exceptions. But in general, that's the situation. So I think we need that kind of investigation. It's got to obviously be collaborative between the clinicians who, you know, really know what they're dealing with as a lived reality, and then the neuroscientists and psychologists who have some, you know, built up experience in the complexities of investigating consciousness, especially with regard to retrospective reports about experiences that are sometime later on in relationship to when the experience seems in memory to have happened.
Mm. We'll touch on that in a minute, but I wanted to circle back and talk about the University of Michigan study because I think it hits on a point that you just made, which is that, you know, you're saying, hey, let's not be so sure about what these cardiologists are saying and their experience with their patients. And I'm much more skeptical of the neuroscientists that dabble into this. So, you know, you had the University of Michigan study that you described with the brain surge in dying rats. It got a lot of play in the mainstream science media, especially among NDE skeptics. I looked into this as well. I looked into it a few years ago, actually, with George Washington University Medical Center professor, Dr. Lakhmir Chawla, who found a similar result in humans. It's the same kind of thing, brain surge. And I also looked at the University of Michigan thing. You know, a few things to say about it. First, it's not an NDE study. Neither one of them are, right? They didn't study NDEs. They didn't study NDE experiencers. They didn't even review the NDE literature as part of their published work. They just, both of them just made this little kind of comment at the end, like, hey, man, maybe this has something to do with NDEs. So, you know, there, when you talk about clinicians, cardiologists like von Lommel, not, you know, really coordinating with neuroscience, I think it's much, much worse on the other way around. But here's the real problem with all that research. It's just so obviously flawed. I have to tell you, you know, before I talked to Chawla about the brain surge thing, I talked to a couple of near-death experience researchers. And privately, they said, Alex, this is the dumbest explanation yet from the NDE skeptics. And they said so because of a couple of reasons. One is, you know what, this whole idea of this surge in the electrical activity is part of this last gasp of a dying brain theory that you describe quite nicely in your dying book that folks can get on Amazon. And it's this idea that the brain goes through these kind of unique physical changes right before it dies. And then the speculation is that kind of physical shutdown is somehow related to the NDE thing. But, you know, one of the biggest problems with that is that not all NDEs occur during cardiac arrest. And you know this, but obviously, you know, the reason that there's so much work in NDEs with cardiac arrest is because we can know and predict exactly what's going on in the brain without really looking at the brain. So these guys said, okay, we have all these NDE accounts. We're not sure what's going on. Oh, here's a great idea. Let's go in the cardiac arrest ward because now we know, you know, after you've had a cardiac arrest, the brain is shut down. But if you look beyond that, we have people who have near-death experiences that have no physical trauma. That should have raised a huge red flag for these folks that want to say the brain surge in this dying rat is somehow connected to near-death experience. It certainly wouldn't fit any of those cases where someone doesn't have a dying brain. But the other way that this fails, this surge in activity of a dying brain, is that there's a continuity of experience to these near-death experiences. Not all the time, but a lot of times there are. I mean, you'll hear folks say, okay, I was stabbed, you know, and I was laying there dying on the street and I was barely conscious. And then I went out and then I kind of regained consciousness and they put me in the ambulance. And then I was floating above my body as the ambulance was driving to the hospital and I saw all these NDE things. Then I regained consciousness and I saw the lights inside the hospital. And then I lost consciousness. So there's this continuity of experience that they're reporting. It isn't like this, what the University of Michigan and Chawla are talking in terms of this dying brain. It's not that it can't be, but it certainly doesn't fit. So again, here are some folks that are just not really deeply looking at the near-death experience data, but are, there's no other way around it. They're taking a debunking position. It's apologetics. It's working backwards from the answer we want, which is, hey, our existing neurological model holds up fine. We just need to shore it up here and shore it up here and change this. Because an objective look at the data, I think it just doesn't fit.
Yeah, so there are a lot of points there that I think are worth, you know, going at maybe one by one. So with regard to the study on the dying rat brain, I agree that linking that specifically to near-death experience in humans doesn't work. All I would want to claim on the basis of that study is that the idea that the brain shuts down when you have a cardiac arrest is just way too simplistic. That rather, the brain is this complex system with different kinds of rhythms of activity, and that those, in a case of cardiac arrest, they have a certain profile, and that profile can actually last for a certain amount of time. So the only thing that study tells us is that in animals who are like us in some ways and not like us in other ways, when cardiac arrest happens, it's not the case that the brain just shuts down. There's a huge cascade of all sorts of different complicated things going on. So the only link that provides to near-death experiences is to just caution us, if we were to say, well, cardiac arrest, the brain is shut down, we can't say that. And that study does actually suffice to make that point. It doesn't suffice to provide us with a model of near-death experiences. I agree that the remarks made in that paper linking the study to near-death experiences are made with some leaps and bounds. A definitely a more cautious link would have been better to see. But nonetheless, there is this, you know, important point about what happens to the brain when cardiac arrest occurs, and that study is informative with regard to that. Now, with regard to near-death experiences happening in situations other than cardiac arrest, well, if we're using the term near-death experience to mean experiences with certain features that are scored in a certain way based on the reports that individuals give after the experience, of course that's true, and that's an important fact. Two things to say there.
But wait a minute, just to be clear. I mean, I'm talking about white light, seeing God, you know, the whole shebang, and from jumping off a bridge or from being frightened that my plane is going
to
crash.
So hold on. It's important for listeners to know that there are different elements that are scored or weighted in order to make up, which is something that's ultimately a construct, to make up a near-death experience. Individuals don't all have the same things happening when they have an experience that someone scores as a near-death experience. Different things can happen according to what is reported. Some elements are weighted in certain ways, and the researcher will say, okay, that fits what we mean by a near-death experience. Now, that can happen in different situations, most of which involve trauma, not necessarily cardiac arrest. So the two things to say there are, well, nevertheless, people want to point to the cardiac arrest case as a special case because they think that case provides a basis for saying consciousness transcends the brain. And that's what I am not convinced by. And then more generally, in the case of trauma, well, that tells us something, you know, important about what can happen in situations of trauma, that there can be these kinds of experiences that have these different, you know, dissociative elements, like out of body experiences. I mean, out of body experiences, for that matter, can happen in sometimes in non-traumatic situations conditions as well. So just that one element alone. And in those cases, no one wants to make any inference about consciousness transcending the brain, because the brain is still there and working and the body is still there and functioning. It's only in the case of cardiac arrest that people want to say that. So it depends.
I don't think that's true, Evan. I mean, I think what people are saying is that we have completely different physiological situations, and that therefore you guys who are peddling this brain shutting down or it's all about the brain thing, it falls apart. It doesn't fit, because this person over there had a well-functioning brain and this person over here had a brain that was severely compromised. And you can't have it both ways. You can't say this person experienced a near-death experience because their brain was in the last gasp of a dying brain, and this person over here had a near-death experience that we can score it any way we want, and it's identical to the other one, and their brain wasn't compromised at all. So I think what people are saying is kind of the opposite of what you're saying, is that this suggests that we have to look past the current neuroscience mind equals brain model and look at all the other data that points in this way and look at consciousness as being something more, perhaps consciousness being fundamental and perhaps being the real construct of reality, and that the brain is interacting with that kind of consciousness. And we don't have to advance that theory. All we have to do is falsify the existing neuroscience model that suggests, as you've advanced, that the brain is the biological basis for consciousness.
Well, in the case of the near-death experiences happening in cardiac arrest and non-cardiac arrest situations, the common factor that people point to is trauma. And then they try to determine from a neuroscience perspective, okay, what's the situation with regard to the brain in relation to that kind of trauma? And then people say, but look, in cardiac arrest, the brain is shut down. And so that's where the Michigan study is relevant, is to say, well, no, you can't infer that the brain is shut down. Now, that does not provide us with a neurological model of these experiences. I agree with you that, that's way too quick, but that's, you know, the logic as I see it. Now, in terms of consciousness, you know, being fundamental to the nature of reality, I mean, that could very well be the case, but I see that as a huge step, inferential leap that these experiences don't provide us. So the models that people, let's call them the non or anti-materialist models that people, for example, like Pim van Lommel want to provide for these experiences, strike me as extremely unconvincing and weak. People want to jump from the difficulties we have with explaining these experiences in terms of current neuroscience to all sorts of alternative models in which quantum mechanics is usually invoked, because quantum mechanics is, you know, very weird and hard to understand. And so consciousness is weird and hard to understand. So it seems like there's a link there. These are not compelling to me at all. I think if it turns out that near-death experiences really do definitively falsify a current neuroscience model of consciousness, if that turns out to be the case, then what's likely to be proposed is a new model that's going to be, you know, well tied to science in some way. And these alternative models that we're being proposed with, that we're being presented with, don't seem to me to meet that standard at all. They seem wildly speculative to me. And so I find those very unconvincing.
Let's talk a little bit about quantum physics, because I haven't brought it up, but I think the skeptical claim on it is exactly what you kind of sketched out there, that, oh, you guys are so woo-woo and loosey-goosey with trying to sprinkle on the quantum magic on that. I don't know that that's the case at all. I mean, I think the fundamental question in quantum physics, and it has been for 80 years, has been, you know, why are we doing shut up and calculate, right? So early on in quantum physics, these guys observed that, hey, you know, the double slit experiment, is it a wave? Is it a particle? The observer effect seems to change it, seems to collapse the wave function. So the fundamental question with quantum physics was, does consciousness, does the observer make a difference? And what they decided was, well, screw that. Don't worry about that philosophical question. Shut up and calculate. We have a good probability function for looking at these quantum effects, and let's just see what we can build out of it. And they built some amazing things about it. Our entire technological infrastructure now is dependent on that understanding of quantum physics. But it just kind of sidestepped the fundamental question of, is the observer really at play here? Well, that question has been answered now conclusively by Dean Radin at IONS Institute. Dr. Dean Radin, well-respected scientist, he did a really simple experiment. He put a meditator, a mindfulness person, in a completely controlled, he has this complex cage that's controlled from every which way, and he was shooting the photon beams just like they did 80 years ago or 100 years ago in the double slit experiment, and was testing whether or not the meditator could change it from a wave pattern to a particle pattern. And he did. Highly statistically significant results over and over again. So there's a real misunderstanding about quantum mechanics. And just because we've sidestepped the question and marched on with all this wonderful, beautiful technology doesn't mean that we've answered the fundamental question of whether consciousness is involved down at that level. But I would suggest to you that that question has been answered conclusively by Dean Radin's work.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I'm not, how would I put it? I'm not, I suppose, educated enough with regard to the intricacies of quantum physics to, really make meaningful or intelligent comments about quantum physics in relationship to consciousness. I know that, I have friends who are physicists, and there's a range of views among physicists themselves. And, I defer to them on that. So it's not something I talk about in my book. The only point I make about quantum physics just in our conversation is just I don't find it convincing when people in the context of the near-death experience work, jump to quantum models of consciousness as a way to deal with near-death experiences. I find that very unconvincing, and I find the two extremes that we see, I suppose, the sort of neuroscience reductionist extreme, which says, okay, we don't really have to revise our understanding of the brain very much to deal with these experiences. And then the other extreme, which says neuroscience, can't handle this at all. This is evidence of a transcendent spiritual reality. I find both of those extremes not very compelling. And I think it's actually more important really to study the experiences on their own terms and get a lot more knowledge and information about them and what they mean for people, rather than trying to fit them into a pre-existing spiritualist or materialist agenda. With regard to Dean Radin's work, I just don't know that work intimately enough to be able to comment on it. So I can't say anything terribly informative about that.
Sure. And, Evan, you do a masterful job of trying to walk this razor's edge, and in Waking, Dreaming, Being, you talk about not just near-death experiences, but broadly about this sense of self and consciousness. Perhaps you could tell folks a little bit about your take on dreaming, because I think you have some really interesting ideas about lucid dreaming and about how dreaming in general is being understood by neuroscience and what that means relative to consciousness.
Yeah. So the way that I approach dreaming and lucid dreaming in the book is through the idea that when we are talking about consciousness, we can distinguish between awareness itself and then what we are aware of, the changing contents of consciousness, and then the way that we identify with some of those contents of consciousness as the self and others as not self. So, for example, when we're awake, our sense of self is very much grounded on our feeling of being embodied. It's a sense of self that very much has to do with perception and action and shifting attention. But of course, when we mind wander or when we daydream, we get caught up in a mental autobiographical sense of self that has to do with how we represent ourselves in the past through memory or project ourselves into the future. And so that's a distinctly mental sense of self. And in the case of falling asleep and dreaming and lucid dreaming, we see similar kinds of changes in our self-experience, so that in a dream, for example, in one sense, the whole dream is nothing but a content of your awareness, but you experience some things in the dream as you and other things as not you. You may experience the dream from within the dream world in a kind of first-person perspective, or you may see yourself from the outside in a dream. You can have the same kind of difference of perspective on yourself in the case of memory. You might relive a memory experience from within in a first-person perspective, or see yourself from the outside from a third-person perspective. So memory and dreams have similar structures of self-experience. But in the case of a memory, it's an image being called up from your sense of your personal past, whereas in the dream, it feels immediate. It feels as if, you know, you're in a dream world. And then in the case of lucid dreaming, where you can become aware of the dream as a dream, you have another change in your sense of self, because you can distinguish between the sense of self that is the watcher or the witnesser of the dream state as a whole versus whatever particular form you happen to take in the dream. And in some religious contemplative traditions, lucid dreaming is an important vehicle for certain kinds of meditation practices. So especially in Tibetan Buddhism, in lucid dreaming, you can, because you're aware of the dream as a dream, you can work on trying to transform emotions, because emotions are very intense in lucid dreams, or in dreams in general. But in a lucid dream, you have the ability to be aware of what you're feeling and to transform anger into love, for example, or simply to develop a kind of mindfulness of the dream state as a mental creation. So this is very important in certain kinds of Tibetan Buddhist and yoga meditation practices. So I talk about lucid dreaming from those perspectives of philosophy, of self and mind, of meditation. And then we're starting to learn a bit about lucid dreaming from a neuroscience perspective. There's now EEG and fMRI experiments with individuals who are reliable lucid dreamers who can use prearranged eye movement signals to signal when they become lucid in the dream. So the idea is that when you're in a dream in rapid eye movement sleep, when you move your eyes in the dream, there's a correlation with movements of your physical eyes, you know, the eyes of the body in the bed. And so if you look left, right, left, right, left, right in the dream, it will correlate with left, right, eye movements, physical eye movements, which are immediately noticeable on the eye trace, because they're not the sort of typical darting about rapid eye movements of rapid eye movement sleep. So you can use in individuals who are very reliable, robust lucid dreamers, you can use the eye movements as a prearranged signal to tell the scientist or the clinician in the sleep lab, you know, oh, I'm having a lucid dream now. And you can use that then to mark the periods of brain activity to contrast lucid rapid eye movement sleep with non-lucid rapid eye movement sleep. And so it, you know, we find again, there are things that make lucid dreaming similar to being awake, but different from it, similar to non-lucid dreaming, but different from it. It appears to be a kind of, you know, distinct, robust state of consciousness that we human beings are capable of in sleep.
Yeah, it really is a fascinating topic. How does all this play with your philosophy friends? I mean, you are a professor of philosophy, and yet you're kind of so broadly kind of spread out here in so many different, delightful, but different areas of Buddhism, and as well as neuroscience and consciousness. How does all that play?
Well, that probably depends on who you talk to. I think, you know, that I've gotten a lot of favorable responses to the book from people who work in philosophy of mind, particularly people who work in what's coming to be called cross-cultural philosophy of mind. So that's an area where we're interested in comparing and using the resources from different philosophical traditions like Indian philosophy and Western philosophy to address problems about the self and consciousness. So there's kind of growing movement of people working on this. And, you know, so I've gotten very favorable responses from a number of those people. You know, some of my friends, philosopher of mind friends, make fun of me for my, you know, what they call my hippie upbringing and how that informs the book. And, you know, that's definitely there. That's just part of the backstory of how I came to, you know, be kind of concerned with putting together these different pieces. But there's a lot of neuroscience and cognitive science in the book too. And, you know, I've gotten some very favorable responses from friends and colleagues in neuroscience who have found it useful and helpful to them. So I'm encouraged by all of that.
what's next for you, Dr. Thompson? What's the follow-on to waking, dreaming, being?
Well, actually, there's two things. So one is very much what we were talking about a lot today, and that is to continue this exploration of death and dying, not so much in relation to near-death experiences, but much more from the perspective of the importance for our human existence and for philosophy of the fact that, you know, we are all of us going to face death in one way or another. And that philosophy in the ancient world was very much about giving people a perspective from which to deal with the inevitability of death. And I think that that's something that, that modern philosophy has lost touch with and that is being thrown back at us, especially because of the advances in medicine. You know, we have things like, you know, movements in hospice care because dying in hospitals is so horrendous. And we have these experiences that are now, you know, increasingly reported, that like near-death experiences that wouldn't have been reported so much in earlier times because of, or at least not the ones in cardiac arrest, because, you know, we have these new resuscitation techniques. So I think, you know, biomedicine doesn't really have anything deep and informative to say about death, and that's philosophy's job. But philosophy hasn't really been living up to that job description since the ancient world. So I want to step up to that and write something about that, growing out of the chapter on dying and death in Waking, Dreaming, Being. And then another project that I'm very interested in is memory. Memory is something that comes up in Waking, Dreaming, and Being a number of places. But I'm thinking that I might want to write something specifically, where that's specifically on memory, where that's the larger theme. And, that really hasn't taken shape yet. That's more kind of idea in gestation for me at the moment.
Well, you have a lot laid out in front of you on the path, so that's awesome. You'll stay busy. Again, folks, the book Waking, Dreaming, Being, Self and Consciousness in Neuroscience, Meditation, and Philosophy. Do check it out. It was recommended to me by many listeners of this show, and it is quite an amazing read. Our guest has been Dr. Evan Thompson from the University of British Columbia. Evan, thank you again so much for joining me.
Thanks very much for having me. It's been a lot of fun talking to you.
Thanks again to Dr. Evan Thompson for joining me today on Skeptico. The one question I wanted to draw out and possibly generate a dialogue with you about, do you think the neuroscience model of consciousness can remain intact if one grants that we have this phenomenon, near-death experience, that totally doesn't fit the model? So what I hear in this dialogue is someone saying, I don't accept your data for this. I wish the data was better here. I wish the data was better there. But at the same time saying, yes, I do accept that the data points to a falsification of the simplistic model that we've been operating under up till now. This, to me, is a bridge to nowhere. They're trying to move past what's been falsified, and they're vaguely and unconvincingly suggesting that they have a path to where they can go inside of their neuroscience model. I don't think they do. And I don't think the smoke and mirrors trick of an emergent property of consciousness is very convincing to many people. Just like I don't think the last gasp of a dying brain NDE hypothesis is very convincing. If anything, what we have is the last gasp of the mind equals brain, you are a biological robot paradigm. But that's what I think. What do you think? Join in the discussion on this topic. Join me at the Skeptico Forum. Leave a message on the Skeptico website. You can find it all at skeptiko.com. There you'll find links to all our previous shows, all available for free. You can subscribe on iTunes. You can get us through Stitcher. All that stuff is available. I also have a couple more shows on this topic coming up that I think you'll enjoy, and one that I haven't lined up yet, but I hope to, with a near-death experience researcher, to add maybe a finishing touch to this dialogue about how and why near-death experience science is still being misunderstood by the mainstream. So all of that's coming up. I do hope you stay with me for it. Until next time, take care, and bye for now.